You are Locked On Vikings, your daily Minnesota Vikings podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
I want to start today's show with a story that you've probably heard before. It's one from the Bible, and it is the infamous story of Abraham and Isaac, the one where Abraham has to go up a hill and sacrifice his son in the name of God. Now, bear with me. You didn't click on the wrong podcast. This is a Vikings podcast. But I found myself thinking about that story when I was doing the research for this episode. It'll come around in a second. It'll make sense, I promise. But I think about that story a lot because it's one that people use to kind of make fun of religion a lot. And I'm not a particularly religious person, but I like to think I have a respect enough for it to learn about it. And I hear all the time with regard to that story, oh my goodness, you know, we built an entire like trio of religions based off of Abraham, based off this guy that was willing to like throw his son into a fire in the name of like a voice in the sky. And I think if you think about that story as little as possible, I can see how you would come up with that takeaway. But if you look at the actual story and putting aside the lesson you're supposed to learn from it, which is all about like, you know, faith and you'll get rewarded. Really, that story is about a pretty loyal person in Abraham. He's loyal to God. He's loyal to his family, being kind of put into conflict. He either has to betray God by not listening to him or betray his son by sacrificing him. And so when his loyalty is put into conflict, for my money, the best thing that he can think of to do is to go with the instruction, because he trusts, of course, and he has all this faith that everything's going to work out. And of course, it does. When he goes to sacrifice his son, the voice in the sky, God tells him, hey, whoa, slow down, don't do that, this was just a test and you passed. And I think that probably was the best chance to, you know, save his son, because of course, if he turns his back on God, this was the Old Testament, who knows what could have happened to you. So all of that is to say that loyalty can get complicated when it's challenged, when it's put into conflict with other loyalty. And people who want to be loyal, people who want to keep their promises, can sometimes be put in positions where they have to make a really difficult choice. And that brings me to one of the players that I want to profile for you today, Vikings rookie Harrison Hand. Harrison Hand grew up in New Jersey, and he went to Cherry Hill West High School in the state. And he played there in a fairly good high school program. And of course, as all of, you know, players who are going to get a chance in the NFL, he was pretty kind of a stud there. And he ends up getting recruited pretty hard, getting phone calls and visits and stuff from something called IMG Academy in Florida. And if you're unfamiliar, it's this like blue blood prep high school football program that like grooms players to go be college superstars. Guys, you know, names you've heard that have come out of there, like Matt Barkley and Matt Leinart, both of them went to USC and had great careers at USC, Bo Scarborough, and like a bunch of people who end up getting, you know, NFL shots. It's this great program for high school people. So Harrison Hand basically has this opportunity to go through the blue blood training and go through, you know, it's going to help his recruiting and just have this huge career boost. And he turns it down. And this is the first moment that I think kind of previews something that happens later in his career, where he picks his personal loyalty, his personal relationship, over the advancement of his career. And he does something that maybe isn't as good for his prospects in the NFL, but in his heart, he's just doing what's right. And I think that's important to kind of understand, because later in his career, so he ends up going to Baylor, and his secondary coach there is a guy by the name of Fran Brown. And he develops this really close relationship with Fran Brown, who teaches him a lot of technique, teaches him a lot of, you know, just kind of like being an adult and a lot of that mentorship that you get from your college coach, and they grow very, very close. Well, Fran Brown ends up with an opportunity to go back to Temple, where he coached before. He coached at Temple, he took a little sabbatical at Baylor, I guess, and now he's going back to Temple. Now, Temple is no slouch of a program, right? And you're in the AAC, you've got to contend with, like, UCF and Cincinnati, and they can put out pretty good teams sometimes, but Baylor in the Big 12 going up against Oklahoma every year is going to definitely be, like, a more blue blood program. But when there are some family issues going on in Harrison Hand's home life, and, of course, Fran Brown is leaving Texas to go to Baylor, which is in Philadelphia, he wants to go be a little closer to home, and so he transfers. And when you have somebody transfer their senior year from a bigger school like Baylor to a smaller school like Temple, and again, Temple's not like a tiny, it's not like, you know, FBS or anything, but it's not going to produce as many draftees as Baylor will on a year-to-year basis. And I think this is a real thing that happens in the NFL, and you'd be hard-pressed to convince me otherwise. I really think that when you have these things that on the surface, just like the Abraham story, when you look at them and think about them as little as you possibly can, you're going to come away with the wrong conclusion. If you see somebody who was at Temple or who was at Baylor go transfer to Temple, your first thought is, okay, what went wrong? Something was wrong. And that's not really the case here with Harrison Hand. He just had a really good relationship with his coach. He misses his teammates and all that stuff, and he has to, you know, break his loyalty to Baylor, but he wants to be closer to home. He wants to be closer to his family. He wants to follow the coach that has, you know, become like this mentorship figure to him. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but on the surface, if you don't think about it for more than 2 seconds, you could easily be tricked into not really looking at the kid or even just being less inclined to give him a fair shake. And I'm not accusing any NFL teams of actually doing this or like overlooking him or look, he's such a sleeper or really making any, you know, this is again, this is a story time series. This is not an evaluative series. This isn't a take that like really he should have been drafted higher or anything like that. I don't really have the information to say that. And ultimately, I defer to consensus and all the draft people who are way smarter than me on that kind of thing anyways. But to me, looking into Harrison Hand's story tells a story of loyalty, somebody who at multiple junctures sacrificed momentum in his career to stay loyal to those close to him. And there's something kind of special about that that I really respect. Now that he's on the Vikings, of course, he gets picked in the fifth round. He's the third corner to come off the board for the Vikings, and he maybe moves to safety. His skill set is like a lot more. I mean, he's a very like heady guy, and he maybe had like some man coverage issues and all that. And so the plan for him might be to move him to safety and add a little bit of competition right there. If you didn't do that, right now the Vikings roster only has 4 players under contract at safety. They typically roster 4 safeties, so you'd essentially be guaranteeing a roster spot to Brian Cole and Josh Metellus, 2 other draft picks we'll cover at a later date. And so moving Harrison Hand to that safety spot would add a little bit of competition into the room. That said, the starters are as entrenched as starters can get there, so having extra competition, I mean, this isn't a thing where you need, like, Robert Blanton, Andrew Sendejo, and Mistral Raymond all in the room, you know, who's going to be starting. You just maybe want to get another person in there so that guys have to earn their roster spot a little more. Or they could keep him at corner. He played outside at Temple. He might factor in better as a nickel corner in the NFL just because of his height, and that's kind of where he's going to be. So it'll be interesting to see when it comes to, you know, the actual 11-on-11 drills where he ends up lining up, and the roles that the Vikings end up having him do will probably have a big impact on his career. But when it comes to his story and the journey that took him here, I really wanted to hit loyalty as the theme, because that's the theme that really stuck out when learning about where Harrison Hand came from. If you are new to this show, I promise not every episode is that weird, not every segment is that weird. I got a couple more things coming up, but I didn't actually introduce myself because of the Bible story at the beginning there. So hello, everybody. Welcome to Locked On Vikings. I'm Luke Braun. I'm your host, your pal, and the kid you copied off in math class. You can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL and yell at me if you hated this. You can also yell at me at Locked On Vikings. That's the show's Twitter page. This show is available anywhere you find your favorite podcast, or you can simply ask your smart device to play podcast Locked On Vikings. Today, in addition to that story, I'm going to cover Oli Udoh. That's who I was going to cover yesterday, but I ended up talking too much about Braylon Addison because his story is wild and very fun. And I also have a very hot take that I'm going to, I don't know if it's that hot of a take. It's one that I've said before, but it's the one in the title. I think James Lynch is going to beat out Shamar Stephen in the preseason, and I'm going to back up that take. It's something that I talked about a ton when I did all the crossovers for the last 2 weeks. A lot of people said, who's your draft class sleeper? I said James Lynch, and so I kind of wanted to go more in depth on that. But before I do any of that, I got to talk to you about Built Bar. Built Bar is a protein bar, post-workout, breakfast, or even a late-night guilt-free treat that is, I guess, comparable to like a Clif Bar. But unlike a Clif Bar where it's like chock full of sugar, and I don't really like that much sugar, especially if it's going to be the first thing I have in the morning or I have it like right after a workout, it doesn't feel very good. These are pretty low in sugar. They're pretty good for you. They're chock full of protein and stuff, and they have this really rich, luscious, chocolatey flavor that I really love. And they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, all sorts of flavors. You know, they've got a chocolate raspberry, a double fudge brownie, a chocolate peanut butter, kind of whatever your speed is. So if you go to builtbar.com, that's where most people order from. And if you go there and order from their website, you can enter promo code Locked On at checkout and you get $10 off of your first order. That's promo code Locked On at builtbar.com. I think for Americans like me and at least most of the listeners of this show, it's difficult to describe the reputation that football has around the world. Of course, we could look at the like national sport of other countries. You know, we could look at soccer, or I guess football as they call it, and we could say, you know, oh, okay, like I see that it's this crazy popular thing and we're just kind of not that into it. But with football, it's different because it has such a barbaric reputation. It's the modern day gladiator. There's CTE and there's all these dangers. And so I always find it interesting when the child of immigrants decides, you know, he's in high school and he decides, I want to play football, and I want to play the position that is going to give me the most head trauma possible. And this is the situation that befell Elisa Mecca Udo, whose parents, Rita and Benjamin, came to America from Nigeria and set up a medical practice in Fayetteville, Ohio. So he's like this honor roll kid with doctor Nigerian immigrant parents, and he goes, hey, I want to do the injury sport. And so when asked about this, they say, yeah, we take a little bit of time to warm up to it. But when it comes to these players, and of course, you know, they necessarily end with the parents allowing the kid to play football, because obviously they're here and that's why we're covering them. But there's always this breakthrough moment for parents. And Rita Uno is no exception. There's a Star Tribune article that was written in the lead up to last year's training camp. I'll link that in the show notes for you, where she just kind of says, like, yeah, it took a little bit of time to warm up to this, but then we saw how much he loved it. And it's always that same line. You're like, oh my goodness, we saw how happy it made him and his commitment. And, you know, we said, okay, we can't possibly deny this to him. And so, of course, you know, this kicks off this huge path that ends up with, you know, this NFL opportunity, and it's this wonderful chapter. But for Oli Udo, there was another thing that he kind of had to overcome, because Oli Udo is a big, 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 big boy. There's a couple of really fun anecdotes in that Star Tribune article about how, like, suddenly the grocery budget started to inflate, and they had to upgrade to a bigger car just to fit the kid. But he had this very, very large weight issue, pun intended, when he ended up at Elon, and of course, you know, only recruited to a small school, and he shows up and he weighs in at 384. Now, I love a big offensive lineman as much as the next guy, but 384 is a bridge too far. And so he has to cut out his diet. He has to, you know, cut out junk food and start watching calories and start, you know, talking about like good carbs and bad carbs and proteins and, you know, trying to figure out how to eat and how to work out and all that. And over the time he plays at, so he has to redshirt his first year. He's like too big to actually be able to play on a football field. And then he kind of has to work his way into the lineup as he sheds more and more and more weight. When it comes time for the actual NFL combine, he's down to like 325. And it's kind of funny with a lot of the people that the Vikings draft on the offensive line, you hear about having to gain weight. You know, that was Ezra Cleveland. He had to put on a bunch of weight. Brian O'Neill had to put on a bunch of weight. Garrett Bradbury has to put on weight. Pat Elflein. All these guys are like, you know, too small for the position and they have to put on weight and strength. And so Oli Udo kind of being the other way and coming back down casts an interesting contrast. And when he was, you know, putting out his best tape at Elon, he has these big long arms and all these perfect like measurables and athleticism for the position. And his coaches at Elon were like, oh yeah, that's an NFL kid. We got an NFL kid. And Rick Dennison, who had just joined the team, is pounding the table for this guy in the sixth round. So if Oli Udo does turn out, you can thank Rick Dennison for doing the Andre Patterson thing, but on the offensive line where he says, that is my guy, take a late round swing on him. I'm going to make him into something. And if he can call his shot and pull that off, then that's an impressive notch in his belt. This season, Oli Udo has a fairly interesting task in front of him in that this offensive line group is kind of set at tackle and he has a whole bunch of potential. And so he kind of has to show that that potential is going to pay off and stop being potential and start being talent. And that's going to kind of be the mission of his preseason. He has to do that to a great enough degree that, you know, that'll make the Vikings cut somebody that they're excited about, like Rashad Hill or Aviant Collins, so that he can be the swing tackle. And that's something that I've actually predicted is like a possibility that he takes the Rashad Hill job away and then the Vikings cut him to save cap or whatever. Of course, if Riley Reiff moves inside to guard and that kind of takes somebody out of the tackle position, then, you know, that opens up the space to keep Oli Udo. But considering a good preseason and a really good performance against Chicago in week 17, including some pretty memorable blocks, some moments to be proud of against the likes of like Khalil Mack, Ole Udo has like a lot of momentum coming into this preseason. So even though, you know, I would still call like a roster, but I think I actually have him in the backup tier just because I can't imagine a scenario where he doesn't make the team. It probably is more fair to put him in the roster bubble tier just because, hey, he's a sixth round pick in his second year. Those guys tend to not be, you know, unless they like are starting or they do a Stephon Diggs thing, like those guys tend to not be guaranteed a roster spot no matter what. So I guess he should go in the roster bubble tier. Like if Ole Udo has a terrible preseason, I don't think he will, but imagine the universe where he surprises us all and has a horrible preseason, he probably doesn't get a roster spot by default. As for the other player on today's show, Harrison Hand, I think he also goes in the roster bubble tier, just being like a day three pick. He'll kind of have to earn his keep, even though I think he has a pretty good chance of earning that keep. He doesn't get it by default. So that's going to be it for story time today. Now I'm going to go on to the takes part where I have an opinion, I guess, and I'm going to try to do my best to build the argument that I think James Lynch, another Vikings draft pick, is capable of beating Shamar Stephen and actually earning the starting three technique job. Or I imagine it's probably going to be a lot of rotation. I don't think there's going to be like a bona fide, this is the guy, like Sheldon Richardson. But I think, you know, the guy that gets the majority of the snaps, I think James Lynch can do it, and I'm going to build that argument. So stick around for that. Okay, so let's talk about James Lynch. Now, I've been really excited about this pick, and like I mentioned earlier in the show, we did all these crossovers in the last couple of weeks with every Locked On show in the AFC South and every Locked On show in the NFC South, and a lot of them wanted to ask about the Vikings draft and said, okay, you guys picked 15 players, what's that about? And so kind of there was a lot of talk about, like, you know, throw them out at the wall and lots of dice rolls and kind of the stuff that I talked with you guys about, like, in the wake of the draft and how probability can kind of be manipulated when you take a lot of bites at the apple. But also, a lot of people wanted to know, okay, who should I watch out of this day? You know, I can't keep track of all these, you know, 12 or 13 or 11 day three guys, I think it was, right? You know, I can't keep track of all 11. Who's the guy that's worth actually watching and paying attention to? My answer was always James Lynch out of Baylor. So a lot of what I'm going to be citing here was compiled in an Athletic article from Arif Hassan, who basically did the whole production and athleticism profile for James Lynch in a very, very detailed way, compiling stuff from Sports Info Solutions and PFF and the Combine and all kinds of contextual data, and the methodology is really sound for it. It's a great piece. I'll link it in the show notes, of course, so you can check all that stuff out for yourself. But the thing that jumps out about James Lynch is that when compared to other players like him, guys that lined up on the edge a lot, did their best work on the edge, but then project to move inside into the NFL, guys like Jonathan Allen is probably the most notable comparison, and there's a whole bunch of other guys like Dean Lowry and stuff, he outproduced all of the guys with that similar athletic profile, and his production at Baylor was incredible, and that's really encouraging. College production absolutely matters. I talk a lot about athleticism and pre-draft, I talked a lot about, like, do they have the athleticism? What about the scores? Too bad we don't have a pro day and all that stuff. But college production, so long as it is measured soundly and held up contextually against, you know, the right parameters, and you're measuring the right things, can be really, really informative and really, really predictive. So when I say college production, I'm not talking about tackles and sacks. Those are not good stats because they typically, you know, they kind of obfuscate the things that lead to those tackles and sacks. I don't necessarily want to see how many times I got a tackle. I want to see how many times he was in the right place and he was in his lane. And Sports Info Solutions has something called bounce rate, which basically says how many times was a running back going at your lane and then decided to go a different way, which would imply that you were in your lane, you were in the right spot, and, you know, you're not like getting washed out of the play or whatever. And it turns out to be a pretty important stat. James Lynch is incredible by that one. He does have a lot of tackles for loss, though I don't care as much about that. He has a very good pressure profile. He has a very good, like, run stop profile, and like the actual like more contextualized tackle stats, like run stops. You know, if you say tackles, you could say, oh, you know, you let the guy get away for 13 yards, you eventually dragged him down, you get credited for a tackle with that, but that's not doesn't necessarily mean you made a good play and shouldn't really go in the win column for you, right? Or if you just say tackles for loss, that means if you make a great play for a 1 yard gain, that's still a good play, but it doesn't go in the win column for you. I like run stops, which mean that the tackle that you made constitutes a loss for the offense in terms of are they more or less likely to score now. So if you go from first and 10 to second and 9, they gained a yard, but they're now less likely to score. It's harder to get out from behind a seven and second and 9 than it is from, you know, first and 10 fresh set of downs. So that tackle goes in the win column, but if you give up 13 yards, that doesn't go in the win column. You don't get any lollipops for making the tackle after the offense got a great play. And so by that run stop percentage, James Lynch, again, very, very positive production profile, and that translates really well into the NFL. Now, that doesn't have a lot to do with Shamar Stephen, but it does show an ability, especially against the run, that is at least a little encouraging. Now, the whole thing with James Lynch and the reason he was available in the fourth round is because he has this length issue. And so you have this edge rusher, because he played off the edge a lot in Baylor, that like isn't that long. And a lot of people say, oh, he should be in a 3-4 and he should play that like 5 technique role. Or, you know, there was some debate over whether or not he could move inside to the 3 technique position. And so a lot of 4-3 teams were going to kind of pass on him and go get somebody who is a little bit less position weird. Now, personally, I think I mentioned this when I did the defensive front thing. I don't think it matters too much whether you're a guy who plays 3 technique, 4-eye, or, 4 technique. Like, all of these little positions, you're moving half a shoulder length left or right, and ultimately a lot of your job is still going to be pin your ears back and penetrate. And you know what? James Lynch is good at that. You know, that whole thing felt to me very much like a he's good, but, I think he's pretty plainly good at football, and there's a bunch of dumb stuff you could talk yourself out of with him, but I think he's good at football. And here's the thing with Shamar Stephen. He's not very good at football. And I hate to do this, right, because I'm a Vikings fan. I don't want to talk crap about my own guys. But Shamar Stephen struggled a lot in 2019. And there's an argument to be made that he was actually the worst starting 3 technique in football. That's unacceptable. You cannot have that at any position. You can't have the worst guy and then just be like, all right, this guy's just fine, right? Even at a position like running, if you have the worst running back in the league, I still think you should put at least some effort into trying, you know, and to improve at the position and not have a guy that like fumbles a whole bunch or whatever makes him the worst. And so here's the role of a Shamar Stephen. And this is what people will say to me when I say, man, Shamar Stephen was bad. People say, oh, you don't get it. His role is this. And here's the argument that people make for Shamar Stephen. I'll try to represent it as purely as I can. The argument is that A, his role is to be a run stopper. And B, his role is to be big and soak up double teams so that the big nose tackle can get one-on-ones more often and you can get one-on-ones on the edge. The basic strategy that the Vikings employed was let's have 2 nose tackles, Linval Joseph and Shamar Stephen, and essentially clog up the middle. You can never move us. You have to use your whole interior line on us every time. And Everson Griffin and Danielle Hunter on the outside get one-on-ones all day. And I will say the one-on-ones paid off decently in that Everson Griffin and Danielle Hunter were both incredible pressure generators, and I don't think they get that if they have to deal with more double teams, right, or more chips or whatever. However, there's a whole bunch of flaws with that argument. So now I'm going to kind of, hopefully I presented the argument correctly, but here's my issue with that argument. For one, Shamar Stephen did not suck up a whole bunch of double teams. Teams just double teamed Linval Joseph, and they actually gave Shamar Stephen a lot of one-on-one guard reps. There was a Seth Walder tracked this throughout the year. I'll link it in the show notes, and you can kind of see. This is on just pass rushes, I think. I don't have access because it's all like ESPN insider stuff or ESPN like media only stuff, like internal stats chart and charting only. So I don't unfortunately have access to the double team numbers for him against the run, but against the pass, he was double teamed very, very, very seldom. He was double teamed way less than Linval Joseph, who wasn't double teamed all that much. Like, I think Joseph was double teamed like a fairly above average amount, but Shamar Stephen was almost never double teamed and basically just got washed out by guards all day. He had a horrendous pressure rate. He was outrushed by rotational edge rushers and rotational guys. Like, he was just like not a pressure generator at all, and he didn't generate run stops or tackles for loss at a very good rate either. So you could kind of make the argument, well, his job was to stop the run. Okay, but he didn't contribute to that. And his job was to suck up double teams so everybody else could get run stops. Okay, but he didn't really do that. And so for me, Shamar Stephen was just kind of dead weight. And it's like playing with 10 players. You know, you just have somebody who cannot contribute and cannot impact what goes on the field. You know, if you're going to have a second nose tackle, that guy better be a gravity well. And Shamar Stephen isn't a gravity well. He doesn't penetrate. He doesn't rush the passer. So here's my argument for James Lynch. James Lynch also is not going to be a gravity well because he's not a second nose tackle. You don't have to double team him all day. But if you're going to double team Michael Pierce, and I do think you kind of have to because he's a decent pass rusher and he's massive, you know, so you'll probably see a lot of double teams go toward Michael Pierce. And that means that everybody's left guard or right guard is going to be one-on-one with the three technique all day long. And that means, and I think this is going to be true in the preseason as well, that means that there's going to be a lot of opportunities if somebody can pass rush to show that they're better than Shamar Stephen. James Lynch can pass rush. And so I think you're going to see in preseason, a lot of protection schemes are very clear, like cut and dry in the preseason. You know, you're not doing a lot of fancy stuff. It's, you know, double the nose tackle and one-on-one everywhere else. And guards that are in competitions, guards that are maybe, you know, not as good or veteran guys, or, you know, even like second team guards, you're going to see a whole bunch of James Lynch one-on-one with a second team guard. And I think he's going to crush those guys. And you're going to start to see a competition swell up. And I think James Lynch can do the same thing against first teamers. And I don't think Shamar Stephen can. He was up against first teamers for all of 2019. If he could pass rush, we would have seen it. So I think that the vanilla protection schemes are going to kind of allow for an opportunity for a good three tech to shine, and that good three tech is going to be James Lynch. I don't really buy the caveats when it comes to, you know, why he fell to the fourth round. I think he can be at least a solid rotational player, if not, you know, take over the job by Halloween. And I feel pretty confident in this take. I mean, yeah, sure, if he totally flames out and he's Jalen Holmes again, then I'll eat crow. But I think that the evidence points very strongly toward James Lynch being somebody who can at least tide the Vikings over until they find a superstar three tech like what Mike Zimmer always wants, like the Sheldon Richardson, the Sharif Floyd. But I think James Lynch can at least play that position at a replacement level, or that is to say, replacement level is a proxy for like, you know, bottom 25% of the lead, like bottom quarter of the league. If you're below replacement level, that means you're below like the 25th percentile. And Shamar Stephen is cleanly below replacement level. And I think James Lynch can step in and be replacement level. So not only do I think he should win, I think he can win a position battle, especially because Shamar Stephen can't take advantage of the pass rushing opportunities that are afforded to him by sharing a defensive line with Linval Joseph and Daniil Hunter and Everson Griffin. And even though that defensive line is a little bit weirder with Ifeanyi Odenigbo and now Michael Pierce, I think the same opportunities will arise. And I think James Lynch just takes better advantage of that on the whole. And we're going to see that in the preseason. So with that, I'm going to sign off for today's episode of Locked On Vikings. If all goes well, got a cool guest coming on tomorrow, so be excited for that. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. Show's on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. The show is available anywhere you find your favorite podcast, or you can simply ask your smart device to play podcast Locked On Vikings. I will see you all tomorrow, and as always, Skol.